So Islam may be compatible, is compatible with democracy. I would say it's not necessarily compatible with liberalism, with liberal democracy, or it can, or I should say, rather than it's not compatible, it's in tension with. So it can be resolved. There is a way to sort of square the circle, but there's a tension there that if we want to be honest as analysts, we have to be willing to address. And if we don't address it, then I think we're almost in a way leaving the space open for far-right bigots because we're not willing to acknowledge something that's right in front of our faces. I mean, I think it's very hard to look at the Middle East or the broader Muslim world and say Islam is exactly the same as other religions, or Islam is just as compatible with liberalism as Christianity was. I think for the ordinary viewer or reader or listener, it's self-evidently the case that this is not, that there is something going on here. So we have to be willing to discuss what that something is.
I'm Quinta Juresic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 30th, 2016. That was Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World, and the author of the new book, Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Shadi came on the podcast to discuss his book, which examines Islam's unique relationship with democratic politics in the modern world. Shadi and Ben take a thoughtful look at liberalism's complex interaction with Islamic history and politics from the Enlightenment through to the present day. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 181, Shadi Hamid on Islamic Exceptionalism.
So, for a long time, there's been a debate in this country and in Europe and in the Islamic world as well about the extent to which Islam is compatible with or incompatible with Western liberalism. And it often has a very shrill tone in which one side, whether it's, you know, General Sisi or, the anti-Sharia people in the United States, assert that there's something fundamentally incompatible and retrograde about Islam, and another side gets incompatible with sort of modern liberalism and democracy, and another side gets very offended by that and points out that, you know, there are 1.3 million Muslims who have a, you know, quite diverse set of attitudes. Your argument seems to have an element of both in it. And you start out with a strong claim that there is something exceptional about Islam, but you don't go where the sort of anti-Sharia people go with it. And so let me start with a really simple, blunt question. Is Islam different?
Oh, there is no doubt in my mind that it is. But for me, difference isn't necessarily a bad thing. And that's where I think I part ways from some on the far right who, when they hear, oh, Islam is exceptional, Islam is different, for them, that's automatically a bad thing, regardless of the content of the argument. So... one thing, though, is that I do think Islam is compatible, quite compatible, actually, with small d democracy. And it's actually interesting that over the past few decades, it's probably been, actually not probably, definitely been Islamists rather than secularists who have embraced procedural democracy more, embraced elections, the parliamentary process. If you look at dictatorship, and the Middle East has a lot of it, over the past six, seven decades, these are very much quote-unquote secular autocrats. Of course, they're not totally secular, and they find ways to use or manipulate religion. So I think that for me, one of my starting points is that I make a distinction between Western liberalism and democracy. So Islam may be compatible, is compatible with democracy. I would say it's not necessarily compatible with liberalism, with liberal democracy, or I should say, rather than it's not compatible, it's in tension with. So it can be resolved. There is a way to sort of square the circle, but there's a tension there that if we want to be honest as analysts, we have to be willing to address. And if we don't address it, then I think we're almost in a way leaving the space open for far-right bigots because we're not willing to acknowledge something that's right in front of our faces. I mean, I think it's very hard to look at the Middle East or the broader Muslim world and say Islam is exactly the same as other religions or Islam is just as compatible with liberalism as Christianity was. I think for the ordinary viewer or reader or listener, it's self-evidently the case that this is not, that there is something going on here. So we have to be willing to discuss what that something is. So that would be my starting point.
Okay, so there's several really big themes packed into that very short and economical explanation. One is a distinction between procedural democracy and liberalism. One is that Islam or Islamism has a different interaction with both than Christianity has historically, and one is that we should be candid about what that difference is that leads to tensions that don't exist in the West or in the Christian world. So let's take those in sequence. When you distinguish between procedural democracy and liberalism, what are you putting in what basket? Is democracy just elections, or is it a rule of law? Is it a sort of broader rule of law culture? You know, what is and isn't Islam in tension with here?
Yeah. So I think democracy can never just be about elections. So there has to be some level of meaningful competition. Other parties need to be able to win. So let's say an Islamist party is in power. If secularists or secular parties have no access to media, they can't organize protests, then that's not democratic in the sense that they don't have a realistic chance of winning if they're closed out of political participation. If secular parties are banned, then obviously they won't have a chance to win and so on. So there has to be at least a minimum level of freedom of expression, freedom to organize. That does not mean, however, that there is going to be full-on Western-style liberalism in the sense of gender equality, minority rights. Those are the things that you're going to have more tension with. And then, you know, and there's interesting things that I think are sort of in a gray zone. They may seem minor, but for example, if an Islamist party wants to restrict or ban alcohol consumption, to what extent would we consider that illiberal? It's illiberal in that that would be a kind of diminishing of individual rights. But there is no constitutional right in any country, at least that I'm aware of, to drink alcohol. So that's not a normal kind of Bill of Rights protected right, but it is part of liberalism in the sense that liberalism is about non-negotiable rights and freedoms and emphasizes the individual and the individual's right to make whatever choices they want in service of the good life. Islamists would have a different conception of the good life, right? That said, I'd also want to be careful not to equate Islamism with Islam. So those are two things, and I think that kind of disclaimer is worth emphasizing. And this is where I think the broader argument comes in, that if you look at the better part of 14 centuries of Islamic history, so the pre-modern era, Islam imbues every aspect of everyday life. No one ever questioned the overarching moral, legal, and religious culture that was in place. You didn't need to be an Islamist to believe in those things. There weren't Islamists in the pre-modern era because no one questioned it, so it didn't need to be asserted. Islamism only makes sense if you're asserting yourself in opposition to something else, in this case, secularism. So in the pre-modern era, this is the way of things. This is in some sense the natural order. It's only when that's challenged in the modern era does the Muslim world have to really contend with these difficult questions of what it means to be modern. And that's also part of the big tension here, is that you're asking a civilization to essentially change its basic foundations. If the basic foundations were very much imbued with Islam in a natural way, now the West has been telling the Muslim world that there is another way to organize state and society. That's where a lot of attention comes in.
So I'm going to focus on this because our readership tends to be lawyers and you know, people who think about rule of law as a sort of particular area. Where do things like independent courts and sort of neutral legal principles figure into this tension? Is that procedural democracy in your framework, and therefore something we should expect that Islamist parties, will be able to embrace? Or is that kind of Western liberalism, institutions that enforce individual rights irrespective of, on the basis of some set of laws that may not be, that may be state and civil in nature rather than religious in nature? Should we think of that as the sort of liberalism that it's really hard for them to embrace, or is it something somewhere in between?
I have to say, I'm increasingly uncomfortable with this word neutral or neutrality. Is anything actually neutral? I don't want to get into a kind of more complex philosophical or political theory discussion about that word, but liberalism, small L liberalism, classical liberalism, is only neutral to those who are already liberal. If you're not a liberal, you would never think that this is a neutral system. Right? So it depends also from what perspective we're coming from. As Americans, you and I, this is what we've grown up with. This is what we know. And it's hard for us to imagine an alternative. So for us, this seems neutral. The state doesn't privilege any one religion or any particular ideology. Well, we can debate that. But certainly, at least in theory, the U.S. is not, as a state structure, is not supposed to privilege any one religion. So, but if you're an Islamist, you would say that Islam is the only neutral system, and that it's only with the advent of modernity and Western imperialism that these new ideologies are coming in and forcing Muslims to be something other than what they had been for 12 or 13 centuries, right? So, but to kind of answer your question more specifically, so I don't think Islamists would have a problem with independent courts, because in fact, the more independent the courts were, the more likely they are to be influenced by religion. Because if society is naturally more conservative and religious, and you have that in many Arab countries where there's a kind of even secularists are kind of conservative religiously, in the sense that they want religion to play at least some role in public life, maybe not as much as others, but some role. So if courts are independent, then they're naturally going to, or autonomous, they're going to draw on that conservative culture that's in the broader society, right? So I think it's inevitable that you'll see some of that in any kind of independent court system. But there's a more challenging question, I think, of if you had a kind of supreme constitutional court, how much of Islamic law should they bring in when they're making their decisions?
Particularly when the legislature looks to other sources. So the sort of situation is, right, the legislature looks to, civil sources, international law, passes something that has no reference to or is in active tension with, the sort of Islamist texts or assumptions. What does a You know, what should an independent court do with that, right?
Well, I think that has to go back to constitutions from the founding moment of a new polity, let's say after a revolution. That's part of what you discuss in the constitution drafting process of how much of a role is Islam, Islamic values, Islamic law, and those are all different things, of course. How much those are supposed to, in theory, play a role from a constitutional standpoint. So in Egypt, when they had this sort of new founding moment, it wasn't totally because it wasn't a full-on revolution, but you know, in 2012, 2013, this was very much a big part of a debate. Would the courts, what would the courts have to say about Islamic law? Because some things legislatively are going to touch on those issues. And there was a discussion of whether Al-Azhar, the premier center of Sunni Islamic learning in Egypt and to some extent the broader Middle East, should Al-Azhar as the religious establishment, should they be able to weigh in and provide an advisory opinion to a Supreme Constitutional Court? And how would that work? Would that be simply advisory? Should it be binding at some later point? But even if it's advisory, in a conservative society, a court is probably not going to be that willing to go against the formal advisory opinion coming from a respected, somewhat respected religious establishment. So those are some of the issues that were being discussed in Egypt. So I think that it's up to every population, polity, to decide how much they want Islamic law to figure into their legal process, but that's an iterative process. You can't decide that overnight. That has to be worked out over time in the kind of give and take of democratic politics, of Supreme Court politics, and we've had that own give and take in our own country, right? So, and that's why it's challenging, and that's why when I think about this, I think, well, we have to let these societies work these things out. We can't come from the outside and say, no, Islamic law should be pushed to the side, and this has to be 100% quote-unquote neutral, or it should be kind of classical liberal approach to the law. It depends. Egyptians might have a different view on this than Tunisians do. And it also will depend on how democratic is the constitution drafting process from the very start. And this is where different models are relevant. And you shouldn't have constitution drafting should not be 100% democratic. It shouldn't be based on whoever has the most representation in society, because for constitutions to hold and to be successful, you want to make sure that everyone, including minorities, have a stake in the process and that it's more consensual rather than majoritarian. But between consensual and majoritarian, there's a lot of shade in between. And there are a number of different models of how you do this. And some constitution drafting processes are much more elite, that you almost have an appointed committee and it's not democratic at all. And then you have models where the parliament, which is democratically elected, will then select a constitution drafting committee. So it will be partly democratic. So there, again, it's different models should be considered there.
So let's talk about the tension with liberalism. You know, when I think about Christianity at the time of the Reformation, I don't think of anything about it as liberal. And so I have a certain attraction to the idea that what we call Christianity today is actually Christianity as inflected by many centuries of liberalism and sort of emerging individualism. And that gives me a certain temptation to the idea that, hey, there's nothing inherent in Islam that makes me say the Islamic world couldn't go through a similar process. You argue that there is something inherent or something very deep. So flesh it out. What is the thing that makes Islam exceptional and that builds in a certain tension with liberalism?
So first of all, I'm not a big fan of this idea that religions can be anything people want them to be. And I think on the liberal left here in the U.S., it's fashionable to assume that, you know, these religions are almost putty in a way, and that nothing is fixed, anything is possible, and Islam can become anything in the future that it wants to become, which is also a little bit, I should say, a little bit patronizing when people say, well, hey, we Christians went through it too, you guys will get there. It just takes time and you're going through growing pains. I mean, that to me makes me quite uncomfortable. It's well-meaning, it's well-intentioned, but, you know. But so I think that each religion or each faith tradition has boundaries. There are creedal requirements in each religion. So if you are a Christian, but then you say that Jesus has no divine attributes and he was just an ordinary guy, maybe a prophet at most, then technically speaking, you're not really a Christian.
Right, you're a Unitarian at that
point. Yeah, you're something else, and that's fine. So Christianity has a founding creed. And if you take Christ out of Christianity, then Christianity doesn't make a whole lot of sense anymore. If you take away the idea that Jesus in some way died for someone's sins, then you start to lose the integrity of the faith tradition. Islam, similarly, has creedal requirements which are very important to this day. So I think that history matters. I think we have to go back to the founding moment and see how did that critical moment when the creedal requirements of the faith were evolving, how did those evolve and how do they manifest themselves 14 centuries later? And they do. And that's what makes it so fascinating to kind of look at this broader historical scope. So a couple things here. One is that, unlike Christianity, where Jesus was a dissident against a reigning state, Prophet Muhammad was someone who had the opportunity to govern. He wasn't just a prophet or a theologian or a cleric. He was also a politician. And not just a politician, he was a head of state. And not just a head of state, but a state builder. All of these things matter because Muslims emulate, or at least are supposed to emulate and admire and love the Prophet. So if the Prophet did something, then it matters, presumably, right? And this also shapes how founding texts evolve. So if we want to understand why the New Testament is the New Testament and why as a scriptural text, it doesn't have much to say about law or governance, the answer to that, in my view, is pretty clear. It's because Jesus was never in a position to govern. So why would the New Testament have a lot to say about those issues? That wasn't the circumstances of the time. However, in Islam, the Quran has to have something to say about law and governance. Even though it's still a minority of the Quran, you know, there are verses that discuss these issues. The Quran has to have something to say about violence, but to be more specific, I think warfare. So when people say, well, what does the Quran have to say about violence? Because Prophet Muhammad and the early Muslims were capturing territory and holding territory, naturally the Quran has to have something to say about that. Otherwise, how would Prophet Muhammad be informed in his decision making? What would he draw on? So that's where it's not an essentialist argument, it's a circumstantial argument, it's a contingent argument that once history happens, there's a kind of path dependency to some extent that will follow on from that point onwards. So, but I think it's also interesting to look at it from the perspective of either a believer or a non-believer. So if you are a Muslim believer, you would say that this was God's plan. So it couldn't have been otherwise. So it was meant to be that Prophet Muhammad would capture and hold territory. And the Quran, almost in a kind of, before history happened, it was decided by God in a kind of sort of vacuum that the Quran would eventually, when it was revealed, address these issues, right? For the believer, it had to be this way. But if you're coming at it from an outsider analytical perspective, you would say it didn't have to be this way, but because circumstances unfolded in 7th century Arabia in this particular sequence, So the Quran had to address law and governance more than the New Testament because of events that happened in the 7th century, which may not have happened in an alternative parallel history. So you can look at the counterfactual and say, well, what if Prophet Muhammad failed in some of those early battles and lost, and the early Muslims were roundly defeated, and Prophet Muhammad was never able to hold territory for long enough to govern, then presumably the Quran in this alternative universe would not have had the same exact verses on those particular issues.
Right, it might look a lot like Judaism, right, which is also a highly legalistic tradition, but the essential developments take place in a period of dispossession, you know, in the wake of sovereign control, right? It's after the, it's under Roman occupation, the Talmud's codified. And yeah. And so there's a, you know, that's a, it's a very interesting, and as a result, the interest in sovereignty is much more theoretical and much less about actual governance of a state that you control, because they in fact don't. But similarly legal in its orientation, rather than as in the Christian tradition, fundamentally spiritual.
Yeah, I mean, Judaism in this regard has more similarities with Islam, but as you're pointing out, history and circumstances matter here, because in this crucial period, after the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 AD. Jews are no longer in a position to have their own state and to govern and to implement laws and a legal vision. So over this crucial period of almost two millennia, Jews and their faith tradition are evolving in a particular way.
But turn it back to liberalism.
Yeah.
So, there is an uninterrupted long, many hundreds of years of Islamic sovereignty and rule in a wide swath of the, why does this create a fundamental tension with liberalism?
Well, so to kind of go back to the Reformation then, you're right to say that the Reformation wasn't liberal. But I would say that it's hard to imagine the Enlightenment happening in the way that it did without first having a Reformation, a Counter-Reformation, the kind of conflicts and tumult that you see in these critical centuries pave the way for the Enlightenment and make it possible, I would say. But ultimately, I think another thing that makes Islam distinctive, and this might be a little bit counterintuitive, is that Islam is very good at absorbing foreign ideas and then retroactively Islamizing them. So where I think Christianity wasn't able to mount an effective resistance to the Enlightenment and to rising secularism in Europe is because Christianity wasn't able to take these new ideas, universal suffrage, mass politics, political parties, procedural democracy. It wasn't able to take those things and to absorb them and then Christianize them, in part because Christianity didn't have an account of public law or governance that could really engage with these explicitly political ideas and issues. And even if we go back to the medieval era, there was always a kind of understanding that there is civil law and there is the law of the church, or canon law. And so that dualism is there from a very, very early period in Christianity. And this is even where the idea of monasteries comes from, the idea that this temporal world has fallen to sin, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. You can try your best, but there's almost a kind of resignation that the temporal world is something, and the kingdom of God is something else. And this is a main theme in St. Augustine's City of God, of course. So, and that's, monasteries sort of take this idea to their logical extreme and say, we as spiritual brothers and sisters have to essentially isolate ourselves from the rest of the temporal world, the rest of society, because everything else has fallen to sin. So that dualism is an important part of Christianity from the early period. That never existed in Islam. So Islam is able to Islam is not forced in this position of dividing between civil and religious. It can incorporate things that seem secular and say, oh, we can just make them Islamic democracy, Islamic Calvinism, Islamic capitalism, Islamic socialism, Islamic music, Islamic rock. Whatever you want, you can just add the word Islamic in front, which gives Islam, I think, a lot of power in the modern era, because it actually works well with modernity in a way. So when we want to ask ourselves, how is it that pretty much every mainstream Islamist movement in the Middle East has come to terms with political parties, even though if we had been talking to each other 100 years ago, there would be considerable suspicion about the very idea of parties, because parties were seen as being naturally divisive. Because to form a political party, that means people are going to form competing political parties and you have to disagree about something. Parties, I think, depend on a certain level of disagreement. And that goes against the idea of Islamic unity, at least to some extent. But over time, more and more Muslims, including Islamists even, are able to incorporate these ideas that are coming from the West. Political parties, mass politics, universal suffrage. So Islam, in that sense, is more flexible. So my argument is not actually an argument for Islam's inflexibility. In some ways, it's an argument for Islam's inherent flexibility and its ability to... So in that sense, you can be fully Muslim and believing and take your religion seriously and not have to choose between being Muslim and being modern. Because you can incorporate at least much of what modernity, in quotation marks, is offering without giving up your Islam. The one thing that you can't, that might be more difficult to incorporate, are the founding assumptions of classical liberalism. But in terms of the other things that we associate with modernity, those things are more easy to incorporate.
And why is there this big accept for the founding concepts of modern liberalism?
Because there has to be something that you keep, right? So liberalism is premised on at least some strains of liberalism. I don't want to overgeneralize too much, but certain aspects of liberalism are premised on the idea that religion has to be relegated to some extent to the private realm. So that undermines the basic starting assumption of Islam. And this is where, again, I think founding moments are relevant. So if you're a secular slash liberal Muslim reformer today, and you're making the case to your fellow Muslims that religion should be privatized in some way, you essentially have to argue against the prophetic model. You can do it, and as I write in the book, there are examples of religious thinkers who have done this and will continue to do this. And some of their arguments, at least to me, are compelling. But to get mass traction, you have to appeal to larger numbers of people, not just elites, or not just the super well-educated, or not just those who have had an encounter with the West, or whatever. And I think there it's a harder sell, because you have to then explain that the prophet's example has to be rethought in this very fundamental way. But how do you do that? And you have to sort of engage in these complex hermeneutical techniques and challenging modes of reinterpretation to make that case. But for the ordinary Muslim who wants to just live a fairly straightforward life and they want the religion to be simple. So in the Middle East, there's this idea that Islam is supposed to be simple, in quotes, even though Islam is not a simple religion from my perspective. But people don't want to overthink their religion. They want to live it, right? So if you're telling them that actually it's a lot more complicated and you have to kind of do this weird reinterpretation, and you have to challenge orthodoxy and all of these things, a lot of people are going to say, we know the prophet. We know that everyone knows that he was a politician. Everyone knows that he was ahead of an incipient state in Medina. That's what they know. That's what you absorb growing up in the Muslim world. So I think it's hard to argue against that. And that's a challenge where it's just a practical argument. So even if we want liberalism in theory, it would be better for it to spread in the Middle East and beyond. My argument is about coming to terms with reality. Whatever we wish things to be, that is fine. We can wish whatever we want. But if we're dealing with the world as it is, we have to be practical and say, this is probably not going to gain mass traction. And that's why I would argue it hasn't gained mass traction. And even in the two examples that I go in depth in the book, where you've had vigorous and often, you know, sometimes brutal attempts at forced secularization, because you might say, well, if Muslims aren't going to go along with it, force them. Turkey and Tunisia are the two examples of that. It didn't really work. And you see in recent decades and in recent years, a resurgence of either Islam or Islamist parties or both. So people's, you know, obviously these two societies are indelibly marked by the experience of forced secularization, but it's clear that there are large numbers of people in both of these countries that want Islam to be a part of their everyday life, and many people have returned to that.
So, to many American Islamophobes, or even non-Islamophobes, there is the fundamental fault line is between those who embrace some form of political Islam and those who do not. So there's no big difference between the Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda or ISIS, except in the limited sense that there's a difference in their embrace of violence versus a sort of tactical embrace of electoral politics. You take the ideational differences between these groups extremely seriously, and that comes out from the very first pages of the book. My question is, given everything you've just said, why? They're both aspiring to emulate the prophet in synthesizing synthesizing the Islam of your personal responsibilities as a Muslim with the Islam of the rule of the state, right? They're both they both have a central tension with liberalism. Why is the right and the far right wrong in saying the Brotherhood is really as big a problem? It may be more dangerous because it has these sort of veneers of democratic engagement, but ultimately there isn't a lot of business to do with political entities that are, that aspire to rule from an Islamic perspective, whether it's, you know, President Erdogan or Ennahda in Tunisia, or, you know, these are just gradations along a spectrum. And you seem to be saying, no, they're actually not gradations along a spectrum. There are some fundamental dividing lines. So spell that out. What are the differences that are really meaningful here within Islamic movements or Islamist movements?
If you come at this question from, let's say you are you're a hardline secularist, a kind of ideologue or advocate, and you think that secularism is the only way to do anything and everything else is a threat to that future, then you're going to see all Islamism as a threat if that's where you're coming from, naturally, because you believe in something and Islamism is not secularism. I believe that as an analyst, as someone who's here to understand. So my starting point as a researcher is we don't have to like Islamists, but we have to understand them. And that requires a certain degree of suspension of judgment. So my personal biases as an American small L liberal, I have to suspend some of those if I really want to truly understand the Islamist movements that I study. And I can't superimpose my own personal biases on them because they are not a product of my world. I'm a product of American society. This is where I'm born and raised, naturally. They are a product of their own societies. So it would be odd if we were judging them according to modern American or European standards of what's acceptable in public life. So that's where I think what I'm really, a big thing that I'm trying to do in this book is to challenge the idea that we all have to become or be liberal or secular. That if we really believe in a pluralistic, diverse world, we have to give people autonomy and choice, and that means they can use that autonomy or choice to end up at different endpoints. And those endpoints may not be liberal or secular. We don't have to like it, but that is everyone's right to believe in what they want to believe in terms of what the good life is, what the purposes of the state are. That's uncomfortable to a lot of people who can't see a world beyond secularism or liberalism. They don't want to believe that's possible. That's a kind of ideological determinism that I'm not comfortable with. And I don't think it allows for the kind of pluralism which is going to be the hallmark of the world that we live in for the rest of our lives. And that includes also white nativists, xenophobes, populists. You know, we're seeing that throughout Europe with Brexit or in the US with the rise of Trump, that these are all people and groups who challenge some of the basic elements of classical liberalism. I would argue that not only are Islamists illiberal Democrats, not all of them, but some of them, but also Donald Trump is an illiberal Democrat.
We may find out whether he's even a Democrat, but he's certainly
that's a good point.
He's certainly a liberal.
So the question I would pose, but to answer your question a little bit more specifically, so look, I think it's important to distinguish between Islamist groups because I've spent a lot of time with various Islamist movements in the region. I've tried to immerse myself in their world in order to truly understand them. And you see the nuances, and it bothers me when you have people who have never met a real-life Islamist in their lives feel that they are qualified to generalize and make sweeping judgments about an entire movement which is very complex and diverse. And I should also say that ISIS, groups like ISIS, consider the Muslim Brotherhood to be apostates. Can you imagine considering, how can you argue that these groups are all the same when ISIS considers some of these other Islamists to be apostates? I mean, come on. And if you accept parliamentary democracy to some extent, and if you accept popular sovereignty, and you accept political parties, that's very different than what ISIS does. Those are worlds apart. ISIS believes all of those things are an infringement on God's sovereignty because they believe that God is the sole lawgiver, so you can't have parliaments that legislate because then you're taking God's responsibilities and giving them to man. And that to them is a fundamental violation of the Islamic creed. So these are very different, not just political approaches or tactical approaches, but philosophical approaches, religious and theological approaches. There are very, very big and foundational between groups like ISIS and some other Islamist movements.
All right, so let's talk about the policy implications of all of this. It seems to me that raises a number of issues. One is whether we're making adequately fine-grained distinctions between different movements. But another is the question of what the irreducible core that we should be demanding of organizations as a sort of price of our engagement. I mean, we're obviously not going to sit down and have a serious conversation with ISIS. But there is this question, you know, how tolerant should we be of the AKP, right? How engaged should we have been with the Brotherhood? There's a lot of recriminations in American circles about having been too engaged with that. What do you think the fundamental policy implications of this book are for how the United States thinks about engaging with Islamist movements?
So I would say the policy implications go beyond how we engage with Islamist movements. And it's more about, and I should also know, this is actually important, that you can have Islamism without Islamists, in the sense that there are ostensibly secular parties in a number of countries, even outside the Arab world, in places like Indonesia and Malaysia. They're secular in quotation marks, but they've actually implemented Islamic laws on the local level. Why? Because in conservative regions, if they want to win, they have to meet the median voter halfway. And again, there's a kind of conservative consensus in these countries where no one's a full-on secularist. They just disagree on how much Islam or what interpretations and so on. So this isn't just about Islamists. It's how we engage with any society or population or electorate where Islam is a prominent part of everyday life. And that would be a lot of countries, right? So in that respect, I think what I hope one of the main takeaways will be from my book is that instead of hoping for outcomes that will likely not happen in our lifetime, such as secularization or the triumph of liberalism, we have to be realistic about how societies are going to evolve, and to have a certain respect for the fact that each society will make its own choices through what we hope will be an iterative democratic process. And that means that when small d democracy and small d liberalism are in tension, as they often will be, and we have to make a choice, I think that we should prioritize small d democracy, because that's more practical, it's more realistic, and I worry that to do otherwise is to contribute to the undermining of democratic transitions in the region, because the people who appeal to this desire for liberalism or secularism are the more autocratic of the lot. And you have so-called secular reformers who are in fact not that and would never be that, like General Sisi in Egypt, who's now the president, who understood that there were many in the West who were scared, very scared of Islamists, and he drew on that fear and he said, I will be your modernizing autocrat. And we see what the results of that are. So to me, the alternative of prioritizing liberalism oftentimes leads to looking the other way when these modernizing reformer types repress their own people and oftentimes repress Islamists. So that's one thing. But I think there's also policy recommendations for Islamists themselves and for other actors on the ground. So one thing I talk about in the final chapter of the book in some detail is the need for power-sharing arrangements. That in those critical moments of transition, that every party in, say, Egypt or Tunisia or whatever has to do their best to move away from majoritarianism. And even if they want to return to majoritarianism in 20 or 30 years, the priority has to be consolidating democratic transitions and making sure they're not aborted. That's what happened in Egypt. There was a transition. It was aborted by a military coup. Part of that was because Islamists became too ambitious and people became afraid. And so-called liberals, Egyptian liberals or secularists or opponents of the Brotherhood, supported a military coup against a democratically elected president. I think the only way to avoid those kinds of outcomes in the short term there's a couple ways to approach it. I mean, one thing I talk about in the book is this idea of essentially suspending any discussion of Sharia or Islamic law or whatever for a kind of interim period. So the Muslim Brotherhood and its secular liberal or leftist counterparts, they would say, we understand that any discussion of Islam or Islamic law is inherently polarizing and might threaten the transition, we're going to table that until we get the transition off the ground. And then once we're confident that there's agreement on constitutional principles, on the rules of the game, then you can have more of open season on these very polarizing debates. But society has to be able to withstand that polarization. But you don't get there overnight. So part of how you get there in the interim period is through various approaches to power sharing, consensual democracy, consociational democracy. There's a whole literature on some of those different approaches. I would say if, you know, the kind of bumper sticker takeaways, one of them, if people don't take anything else when it comes to how you design or how you envision new democracies, one is avoid presidentialism. Parliamentary systems are the way to go. Presidential systems are polarizing because you have one guy, usually a guy, at the top of the system. These are very strong centralized state. So politics becomes more existential because you're worried that this president from the opposing party, who's essentially it's winner take all if you're the president, that is going to impose his vision along with his party's vision on the rest of the state, on the rest of society. There isn't as much room for coalition government, for the kind of, or even if you don't like who you voted for, you gotta wait usually 4 years, right? If you have a parliamentary system, there's no confidence votes. There are early elections.
There's also coalitions within the parliament.
Exactly.
So you're a Muslim, you're, by your own description in this conversation, a liberal Westerner. You've been spending a lot of time for the last 10 years, really, with Islamist movements, and you've been coming to a lot of conclusions that have got to be uncomfortable, both, you know, to the liberal side of you and in other ways to the Muslim side of you. And you know, what do you do with that? When you look through the impulses that guided you and writing this book, how many of them are you comfortable with, and how many, and what do you do with the ones that you know kind of pull you in multiple directions at the same time?
I've had a number of situations. The book's been out for about a month or so now, and you know, people have responded to certain parts of the argument, especially if they don't read the whole book and they read only maybe, you know, a certain teaser article or a small excerpt or whatever. Sometimes they can jump to conclusions that I'm very uncomfortable with and use my own arguments for what I would consider to be bigoted purposes, anti-Muslim purposes, in the sense of saying, well, look, Islam is fundamentally different. We can't let those guys in because they're never going to be liberal or whatever, even though the people who are often making these arguments are themselves not liberal. But putting that aside, so I can see, and I knew in writing the book that there was the potential for my arguments to be misused. So I tried to be as nuanced and detailed as possible in the book, and that's why I would encourage all your listeners to actually buy the book and read as much of it as possible instead of just looking at the headlines. But I think that we as researchers, I mean, for me, what I love most about my own research and writing is when I start a project and I come out of it changed. And I'm, in a sense, a different person because of the process, whether it's a couple years process or longer, that you come out of it and you realize that you've had to revise your own assumptions about something that's important. And that's, to me, what was so exciting and challenging about writing this book. I'm a different person today than I was 3 or 4 years ago, but also because of my experiences in the region. And I think that's what we as researchers have to aspire to do, that we should have conclusions that make us uncomfortable. Otherwise, you know, we're just, and that's why when people say, oh, you know, Shadi, you know, we disagree with you on X, Y, and Z aspect of this book, I'm not actually here to prove my, you know, I hope that people will reassess some of their assumptions after reading my book. But I don't expect or want anyone to agree with me 100% about this book, because first of all, that would be weird. Why should anyone agree with me 100%? I also realize that I'm a product of my own context. So naturally, people who are products of other contexts and other experiences who haven't spent time with Islamists or are strong secular advocates, they're coming at it from a different perspective, and we should respect that. What I do hope, though, is that if people read the book, they're gonna be challenged, they're gonna be uncomfortable, and they're gonna rethink at least some of their assumptions. But I mean, that's the most you can hope for, and I think that's the best thing. The best thing as a writer or researcher is when someone says, "Shadi, I disagreed with like 70% of your book, but there was this 10 or 15% where I had to sort of take a step back, do some rethinking, and I want to look into it more." That might not sound like a victory, right? 70% they disagree with you. But I think that's, maybe I'm different in that respect. I'm not here to prove a point because I believe in what I've written. So even if everyone else in the world disagrees with it, I believe in it. It's important to me. And I hope that it will, I hope that people, well, first of all, enjoy reading it, but also it'll challenge some of where they come from on these issues.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, and email. This week, we bid a fond farewell to Cody Poplin, who's heading off to bigger and better things. Or as he always says...
Well, I don't want to get into a kind of more complex philosophical or political theory discussion about that.